Welcome to AZMCast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the referenced paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the February episode of AZMCast. My voice is mostly back and just in time for the residents' in-training exam next week. This month on the podcast, we are covering something that is likely to increase in volume as our population gets older, oncologic emergencies. Even though we seem to be making great headway with cancer treatment, we are seeing a lot of these patients in the ED. So to help with some board prep, the most unlikely of oncologic experts, Brian, Chris, and I, will discuss the basics of cancer-related emergencies. And I mean the very basics, because we basic EPs. Best of luck to all the residents taking the ITE next week. Sleep well. Remember, you got this. All right, you guys all right? So it's February, and February means in-training exam.
Woo-woo!
Congratulations to those of you who have passed your boards and now get to be in the maintenance of certification cycle instead of having to do this once a year.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. We're going to cover something briefly here. We've cut down how much we think you can actually tolerate us talking about board review. So we're going to cover something that is fairly focused and, something that you're very familiar with. Something Brian just said, he sees like 10 of these a shift, right? Oncologic emergencies?
A career.
Oh, career. Sorry. I misheard that. So we're going to talk about oncology board review for your in-training exam. And for the record, Chris, Brian, and I do not write the in-training exams. We don't know what's on it. I don't even know if any of us passed our in-training exam. Did you?
Well, you know how they break down the results by category, and they're like, well, you did okay in this one and not so good in this one. All I remember is that I did not do well on the oncologic side of it.
So who better to teach you about
That's
it
right.
than us three, right?
That's right?
We tried to get somebody who was a specialist and, you know, kind of get into this a bit more and thought to ourselves, you know what? No, let's let us three morons teach instead. Because then you know you're only getting the true high-yield stuff that even we remember.
Sometimes you just, you know, too much. You know?
Right. So, all right, so let's start with, we're basically going to break this down with things that you'll see in cancer patients kind of broadly. All cancer patients are kind of at risk for these emergencies. And then we'll talk about the blood tumors, the leukemia, lymphoma. Then we'll play a little solid tumor buzzword to kind of go through some of the things that you need to recognize, because most every one of these, you have time to go look it up. It's not like any of these need to roll off your tongue, but you need to be in a situation to go, oh, wait a minute, I've heard of this. I need to go look up and see what I might do for this. So we'll start with the simple things, which is just high calcium and neutropenic fever. Mm. You've probably seen a neutropenic fever in the last few months if you have cancer patients that come to your hospital. Hypercalcemic crises, I don't feel like I've seen all that much, but it's something in the back of your mind you kind of think
so
about.
So I know it sounds kind of weird, but I didn't see a ton. We see a lot of cancer patients here, but we really don't, I feel like, see a ton of hypercalcemia here. So I graduate and I go to Corpus Christi, and I kid you not, I was seeing it probably one a week, maybe one every 2 weeks, hypercalcemia in crisis.
Congratulations. You are now the expert
who had to learn about it.
You're the expert. Wow. You're now leading this discussion.
Yeah. I saw a lot of it,
So what kind of patients did you see it in? Was it just any cancer patients or?
Yeah. Now there's a couple cancers that it's more associated with. Probably the most famous is squamous cell. And you'll see it sometimes with small cell, particularly if they're lysing. But the presentation typically was one of two ways. Either they would come in a little bit altered, or they would come in with abdominal pain. Rarely did someone come in and say, oh, my bones are aching all over. Usually they had that if you asked about it, but it was usually abdominal pain or altered mental status. Now, my favorite one was the one where they came in saying, I think I'm hypercalcemic, or their family member says, I think they're hypercalcemic again, because they're goofy.
Those are great, because that's like I picked up the patient, my first patient I picked up with TTP.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so what's been going on? And she says, I think I'm having TTP again. I was like, which one of us is the doctor here? All right, why don't you let me do my, yes, I think you're correct. So the stones, bones, groans, psychiatric overtones.
Yeah, and sometimes the psychiatric overtones is subtle, but then you think about the mnemonics, you remember that you're supposed to think about it, and you pay attention to the patient a little bit more and go back and take a history, and they actually, a lot of them will have a little bit of kind of a psychiatric flair to them. And you talk to family members, you can ask them, have they been having weird mood swings or severe depression, or just seeming like their personality has changed? And they really frequently will say
now, that. I don't think it's reasonable in the emergency department to pick someone up who's got some joint aches and maybe is a little depressed and find their paraneoplastic tumor. You know, this isn't house. But I think that if you've got somebody who's got cancer, Brian, I know you're not a huge fan of basic labs, but I think all of us can agree, you got cancer and we're putting death back into your body to try to fight another kind of death. You need to check some electrolytes. You need to check some labs and see where people are at.
Even a basic metabolic panel has calcium.
It's right, basic.
Brian? Yeah, it's basic. I agree. I think when a cancer patient, unless they're coming in for a laceration, you're probably going to check some laboratory tests. And for your board exam, they're really going to be throwing very common presentations of hypercalcemia. It's not going to. They're not going to be subtle. They're going to show that the patient has a cancer. Maybe they're going to show you an X-ray that shows large cavitary lung lesions, mm-hmm. or something like that. And then they give you an EKG or maybe a little bit of a history, and they want you to know what's next. So this is not going to be a red herring randomly, and they're going to hide a calcium level from you.
And they're probably going to give you the levels, but they're going to expect you to interpret it. So they'll give you a calcium that's fairly high. They'll give you something of 10, 12, 14, mm-hmm. something that's mm-hmm. pretty high that you mm-hmm. have to go, wow, I don't think I've seen double-digit calciums mm-hmm. in a while. And so when you see that, the other evaluations you want to do, you want to get an EKG, like Brian says. Electrolytes are really good board fodder for your EKG. So hypercalcemia will shorten your QT. Hypocalcemia will lengthen your QT. So something to be aware of as you're treating these patients. And the treatment is going to start with aggressive fluid hydration, lots of fluids. And then the next steps will be diuretics. Remember, loops lose calcium. So you can give them some loop diuretics, flush them out, and try to have them pee that calcium out of their body. You can use bisphosphonates and some of the other stuff. That does not work quickly, though. That takes 12 hours to do. So that might be something after you've talked to their oncologist, or once you've admitted them, that they say, why don't you give them a bisphosphonate? But if they give you if they ask you the question, which of these is the next most important step, it's not going to really be any of the drugs. It's going to be IV hydration.
Hydration, diuretics. Now, there have been some studies on the loop diuretics showing that it may not actually help as much as we think it does.
But I learned it in medical school.
Well, and a lot of these people, they're both dehydrated and third spaced. They still need the diuretics. So I have yet to talk to like a hem-onc doc or the doc that I'm consulted on these hypercalcemic patients that doesn't want diuretics. So I think it's still okay to give. There is one medicine that you didn't mention, calcitonin or salmon calcitonin. And I remember learning about this in med school, and they talked about how well it works and it's very fast acting, but I don't see that showing up on tests. It hasn't shown up on the boards. It's something to know about. It's fast acting and it's short lived. So it's one of those things where if you have someone who's having like severe symptoms and you want to have something that intervenes quickly, add that to your armamentarium. But just know that it's not something that the oncologists are going to be, you know, right, continuing.
So I actually have given that once. Mm-hmm. It was actually a very bizarre case of a, I think he was like 12 or 14 year old kid who had a parathyroid adenoma, and he went into parathyroid storm.
Wow.
I did not know that was a thing, but apparently it's a thing. And his parathyroid was going absolutely crazy, and he was having runs of VTAC. We did quite a bit. We used calcium channel blockers. We did some stuff that, I don't know, has a whole lot of evidence because I just invented a word, parathyroid storm, and that's what I'm calling your disease, but that's exactly what he had going on.
And he obviously had cardiac instability, so you gave him calcium to stay... Wait.
Anyway, so again, just quick review. Hypercalcemia is a problem with quite a few cancers that are out there, solid tumors or blood tumors. And the diagnosis, you're usually going to find it by checking some labs. You may see it on their EKG as a short QT. And you might get some of these stones, bones, groans, psychiatric overtones. You're going to treat it with aggressive IV fluids, and you're going to treat it with diuretics. Anything past that, going all the way to dialysis and anything else, is going to be far outside the reach of what you'll initially start with. You can phone a friend for help at that point.
So a second order question. I don't know if this would ever show up on the boards, but it has to do with the albumin binding of calcium. I know at least comes up in clinical practice. And one way around that is to just get the iCal. So if you want an ionized calcium, just bypass go, skip your calculations with albumin correction. Just remember that in different metabolic states, especially with pH changes, alkalosis causes albumin to bind more readily. Albumin will bind up more of that calcium, and it's the unbound calcium that has a physiologic effect. If you sponge up all of your calcium, then you're going to feel hypocalcemic and have hypocalcinosis.
Couldn't have said it better myself because I didn't know any of that. So no, I probably did at some point. All right, so let's move on to neutropenic fever. So neutropenic fever is something that you're absolutely going to see because we're treating a lot of our patients still with chemo. So neutropenia cutoff is generally going to be an absolute neutrophil count less than 500. So if they come back and they've got an absolute and they've got a white blood cell count of 0.5, there's a good chance that their absolute neutrophil count is less than 500. But these are patients that are prone to opportunistic infections. So we want to treat them more aggressively. You know their immune system is shot. They may be on GM-CSF or something to try to stimulate their bone marrow production again. But if they have a fever, they have a low neutrophil count, these are pretty simple patients that you're just going to draw broad cultures, look for a source, treat with antibiotics, and they're almost always going to be admitted.
Don't forget your neutropenic precautions. Make sure nurses know other people in the room, like family members, know, like, hey, this person's immune system is not very good, so I need you wearing a mask. It's not a bad idea to put a mask on the person, the patient themselves.
Yeah, that's usually the best way to prevent stuff from getting in them. It's like, why don't you wrap yourself up in PPE, and then I don't have to as much. Yeah. But no, we should do both.
The board questions on this will be a cancer patient who's recently undergoing chemo. I mean, that's what you're going to have to see.
The nadir for neutropenia post chemo is typically 7 to 10 days, and so that may be part of the stem also.
Yeah.
When you're receiving chemo, you're prone to fungal infections the same. However, there is no real reason to get antifungals as part of your initial sepsis workup for cancer patients. You know, if it's low, you can talk to the oncologist, that's fine. This is not one of the no-brainers like it should be when you're giving vancomycin and some broad spectrum gram-negative and anaerobic coverage, because those should always be thought of right off the top, especially if they've got an indwelling central line, they've got indwelling PIC line, you know, how something that puts them at more risk. So we're going to treat those patients pretty broadly. There are some scores out there that are being developed for which neutropenic fever patients you can send home, including some work out of UCSD in San Diego. Interesting stuff. It's a little higher level, and you need to make sure an oncologist is on board with that. But for a board especially, you are going to draw broad cultures, you're going to treat with broad antibiotics, and they're going to be admitted until we figure out that it's not bacterial.
Yeah, and they may not give you test results. This is almost like a fever of unknown origin in kids. So, you know, you may get a negative urine, a negative chest X-ray, no skin findings, a soft abdomen. They may tell you all these findings. Just because you don't have a source doesn't mean that they go home. That's I agree on the boards. All these patients will get admitted. There are patients in real life working with the hem-onc doc. You could get home, but that's a small, select, you know, happy few that look great, but they just happen to have a fever and have good follow-up. But for all these, admit them, and don't forget the neutropenic precautions, because that sometimes they like to sneak in just like a tetanus.
And that might be more like an oral board.
Yeah. Correct, kind of, yeah.
In case you're interested, the score is called the CISNE score, C-I-S-N-E, and the other one is called the MASCC Risk Index, M-A-S-C-C Risk Index. And it kind of tries to find low-risk febrile neutropenic patients. Look it up on MDCalc. Kind of interesting to read about. Mm-hmm. It would be nice if at some point we don't have to admit all these people. Mm-hmm. All right, mythology or actuality? Don't do a rectal exam on a neutropenic patient.
Myth.
I want to say it's real, because then I don't get to do a rectal exam on it.
I don't know if it's real or not, but it's out there. And so for your boards, don't do it. Don't stick your finger anywhere. Don't cath these patients. Don't do some of these things. But do you need a rectal exam anyway for any of these patients,
Absolutely
Brian?
Not.
Great. So then don't do it no matter what.
All right. So I think that goes through the whole, like, a septic prostatitis patient, you're not supposed to do a rectal exam on. But the whole point is, and if that's not true, then it wouldn't be true for the other.
I know a guy who knew another guy in medical school that pressed on a hot prostate. The guy coded in front
and
of
died.
Him. It was amazing. It was, yeah, never do it.
The whole point behind neutropenia is that they are
like
not displaying symptoms of their infection, because there's no inflammation there. So how would you know they have prostatitis or not? I think that's the logic, but it just may not be reality.
Yeah. It's like a Control-Alt-Delete button on patients. You just push it. They start over. So let's get to, this is something that's more in my realm, leukemic emergencies. So I see a lot of kids. I see a lot more new-onset leukemia. So young leukemia, high white counts, these are patients that are going to be at higher risk. And the big thing that we always look for when we see a new leukemic, you got to make sure if you see somebody who is pale, you see somebody with petechiae or purpura, you see someone and they come in with a fever, maybe, maybe not, you know that their immune system is not working. So if they have pancytopenia, they have blasts on their CBC, you have to treat them as if they have an infection, because the white cells that are there, you can't guarantee they are working. Now, side note, this is different from something like ITP, where the platelets you have are working just fine, there's just not enough of them. With leukemia, if you have white cells, you have to assume they have all gone rogue and that none of them are doing what they're supposed to do. So for these patients, type and screen, blood culture and antibiotics for a new onset leukemic, because generally this has been going on for a few weeks. And there are a few cutoffs. One thing is a white blood cell count. Once it starts getting too high, you can actually get into this range of a hyperviscosity syndrome. Now, what's the highest white blood cell count you've ever seen?
I think 127.
Probably close to that.
Mine was 1.2 million.
Oh, my God.
That was a high white blood cell count. And they took this kid up to the PEDS ICU, and they got real close to doing an exchange transfusion to, like, you know, old school bloodletting and put blood back in order to get rid of some of these, because their blood was flowing like maple syrup. Yeah. And so the hyperviscosity syndrome, you will really get ischemic type picture. They can have strokes. They can have ST elevation. They can infarct different parts of their lung or their liver or other places. So these patients, when they have ridiculously high white counts in the hundreds of thousands, these are where you're not just calling the oncologist, you're calling the intensivist and saying, hey, do I need to be worried about this? If they're having any of these symptoms that fit with ischemia, then you need to be, you know, hydrating them, but also talking to people about that next step.
Fun fact. Anyone know the unit of measurement of viscosity?
No.
Oh.
Oh, wait. No, I should know this.
No, off the top of my head.
Something called a centipoise.
A centipoise. Okay, I did not know that.
So, you could call him up and say, I think his centiposity is very high.
Ooh.
And no one will understand what you're talking about.
I'm not going to do that. All right, so tumor lysis syndrome is probably the thing that you're going to see far more likely than hyperviscosity syndrome. But this happens with solid tumors as well, but far more when you've got leukemia with high white counts. Basically, all these cells are put together in such a hasty fashion that they don't really function and they fall apart. So you get a bunch of lysed cells. So what pours out of those lysed cells is calcium, potassium, phosphorus, uric acid, and LDH. And so guess what you're checking? Calcium, potassium, phosphorus, uric acid, and LDH. So if you have a new onset leukemic, those are the things to add on to what you've already seen, because tumor lysis syndrome ends in a hyperkalemic death. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that you have those set, and you want to get ahead of it, because it may just kind of start as a little smoldering fire, and then suddenly, whoosh, everything kind of goes crazy. So they'll treat this a few different ways. They'll treat you with fluids for starters.
Definite first-line. Yeah. First-line therapy is fluids.
They'll go down a little further with things like allopurinol and a few other management tactics. But really the big thing for you in the emergency department, look for it. Recognize, man, I've got a kid with leukemia, or I've got this cancer patient with a potassium that's kind of high. Check the other levels that will let you know that this is actually tumor lysis syndrome and that you need to be more aggressive.
They usually look like crap. So the other population that you'll have this in is someone post-cancer treatment. So post-chemo, usually 12 to 72 hours post-chemo. And by far, the lion's share of patients who develop this are either the blood-based cancers or small cell.
So lymphoma emergencies, kind of along the same lines as leukemia, you can still get tumor lysis syndrome. But the couple things I want to mention, SVC syndrome, which is also going to be seen in lung cancers, you're basically going to get from a thrombus or some kind of occlusion of your superior vena cava as it's going up to your neck, and you're going to get this kind of funky looking patient that's blue from, what is it, the head up, and mm-hmm. then kind of pale and sickly from the neck down. I'm fairly certain I had one of these in December, but the patient didn't survive long enough for us to find out. Mm-hmm. But this is, it's a very peculiar picture, and it comes from compression either from a clot or compression from the tumor itself on your superior vena cava. If it's from a clot, heparinize. Mm-hmm. And then if they get really sick, you can think about all the other thrombolytic stuff. That won't be on your test. But otherwise, if it's because of the mass itself, you got to get the mass out of the way. And then that might just be leaning the patient one way or another, definitely not leaning them down, laying them down flat.
Yeah, the vast majority of these people will have some form of edema, like over 80% will have edema of the face. A large number also have it going down one arm or both. But as I was reading, one thing that was interesting, over half of them will be dyspneic. So that's another thing to keep an eye on. And probably because 70% of these are coming from lung cancer, that may have mm-hmm. something to do with it, but mm-hmm. also because of vascular congestion and lymphatic congestion that's dumping in the lung.
Yeah. Treatment will be head of bed elevation, so you sit them up, fluids, cautiously, oxygen, and then chemo radiation if you think it's the tumor and you need to mm-hmm. break it down.
Yeah, and the radiation comes in. There's not a whole lot of rad-onc emergencies. Mm-hmm. This is one of them. If you've got a mass that's impinging on a structure that is not surgically amenable, then rad-onc can shrink that thing with their magic Honey, I Shrunk the Kids ray mm-hmm. And try to get it smaller. So this comes into play with things like epidural compression, cauda from a tumor, and these mediastinal masses. The mediastinal masses can be truly scary. I have seen these things occupy pretty much 3/4 of a patient's chest. and they get, you start laying them back a little bit, like Brian said, head of the bed at 30. If they are not bolt upright at 90, their eyes get really big because this giant tumor is squishing their heart and their lungs. So they do not like being laid flat. They're really not going to appreciate laying flat for a CT scan, and they are really not going to appreciate being intubated. So if you're intubating a mediastinal mass, you got to get ready for all the things that could happen because, and I've talked with Sackles about this as well, if you have to intubate somebody with a mediastinal mass, once you paralyze them, you've taken away all of their intrinsic musculature's ability to hold that mass up, mm-hmm. and then you've just got a lead weight on your heart. And so these patients can arrest. So you may need to, you know, intubate, get them ready, lay them down real quick, intubate them, flip them over, do whatever you need to do. But just be kind of think through the physiology of these strange masses. What's ideal would be to not intubate them and get them the radiation they need in order to shrink this.
Just send them to the CT scanner and just keep it going until the round doc gets there.
Put them through like a car wash.
I think if it's a kid, the radiologists like that too. They really seem happy with multiple CTs.
Multiple CT scans. Yeah. Oh, man. Keep it going. Yeah. This kid I had that had a mass that started to develop some compression, and we ordered, because this is what hemonc's going to need, CT head, neck, chest, abdomen, pelvis, and oh man, did I get an angry phone call until he actually looked at the CT. It was like, oh, okay. So let's do some tumor buzzwords. So Chris, I am an alcoholic with hepatitis C, and you have just done a CT scan of my belly, and you have bad news for me. What do I have?
Probably hepatocellular carcinoma.
Oh, gosh, that's hard for me to hear. Brian, I am a 79-year-old man who is thin, cachectic, and comes in with painless jaundice. What are you going to what bad news do you have for me?
You're dead from pancreatic cancer soon.
All right. I am a chain smoker, 120-pack year history, and I just started coughing up blood, Chris. What's the bad news?
Lung cancer.
Lung cancer. All right. I am an old person, possibly even the same old person that came in with painless jaundice, except that I had a new onset seizure. What do I have, Brian?
You have a date with the CT scanner to look for brain cancer.
Yep. Or, what's very common from a lot of these, Mets. Now, to my knowledge, on the in-training exam, they are not going to ask you which cancer Mets wear. That's a great question for an internist, for an oncologist. That's not something that we need to be particularly aware of because that's diagnosis and it's not as emergent as, you know, the complication from the meds. So I wouldn't worry about that, but it probably is something to be well aware of as an emergency doc, but I don't actually know any of that, so we're not going to cover it.
All right. I do think they can, in questions, show you a picture of a CT scan with a big Goomba in the brain and then talk about, you know, the patient's history, they had a seizure, this was your CT finding, showing that it doesn't look like a bleed. There's very few things they're going to look for, but they could show you that and then say, what do you want to do? Maybe you want to do steroids, maybe you need to ask about cancer history, something like that. Mm-hmm. But they may have you interpret scans. Now, are they going to have you diagnose hepatocellular carcinoma in a belly CT? No, but a head CT, seeing some mass effect and midline shift from a seizure patient, I think is a reasonable thing that they could throw.
Yeah. And I'll make a quick comment that really brain cancer is the only time that you're going to want to give steroids to a cancer patient, because especially in cases of leukemia, you can't, pediatric acute lymphocytic leukemia is ALL is almost universally curable now, which is crazy. But if you give them a dose of steroids and you demarginate all of their cells, now you can't tell what the cancer cells are and what is demarginated blast because you gave a big whack of steroids. So except for brain cancer, stay away from the steroids.
Maybe cord compression also.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be
another one. Yeah.
Radiation would be better. All right, so Chris, I am a 50-year-old smoker who comes in because I am peeing blood. Doesn't hurt, though.
Did you work in an aniline dye factory?
You know, funny you should mention that. I did.
Mm. Sounds like cancer of the vejiga.
Of the vejiga?
Or bladder.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's interesting because the next one is that I'm actually a postmenopausal woman who's having vaginal bleeding. I thought I was done with this, doctor. What do I have, Brian?
You have a date for a endometrial biopsy for endometrial cancer with your OBGYN.
Wonderful. At the end of the day, most of what we're going to do with regards to cancer is buzzwords. There's only a few of these. We talked about treatment because most of these patients need to go on to actually have a date with an oncologist, a date with a surgical oncologist. But looking for all the other complications, it's going to be you've got a bowel obstruction because of your cancer. We know what to do with bowel obstructions. It's going to be that you have a fracture because of your cancer. We know what to do with fractures. But these specific oncologic emergencies are ones to be aware of for your in-training exam and for real life. And we hope this was helpful for you.
Yay.